Welcome to the Big Mike Fun Podcast, where you'll learn about advanced wealth building strategies from real estate investing to creating massive ROI and secure retirement profits. So pour yourself a cup of coffee, grab a notepad, and lean in, because Big Mike has got the mic, starting now.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Mike Zlatnik. I'm CEO of TF Management Group, and this presentation is on the very interesting subject of how to prepare for rising interest rate environment, cap rate worsening, risk of debt crisis, and learning the downside protection investing. This presentation is for educational purposes only. The presenter, myself, is in the private lending business and fund management business. If you're interested to invest in any of our funds, please request the prospectus and the private placement memorandum and consult your financial advisor. Thank you. A couple of words about me. I'm Mike Zlatnik, known as a Big Mike, also big as a big Russian. I'm a CEO of TF Management Group. We currently have two active funds, TF Investment Fund 2 and our flagship fund, Tampa Opportunity Fund. I'm a retired software executive. I spent 14 years in software and retired from that and went into real estate full-time. I've been in the real estate since 2000, part-time until 2009, and a full-time fund manager since 2009. We specialize in short-term bridge lending, hard money funding, and also we invest in long-term value-add equity deals with predictable cash flow and value-add-driven appreciation in sectors like self-storage, multifamily, retail, office, and so forth. I do have a book out called How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Investment Fund, available on Amazon, and I run a podcast called BigMikeFund.com podcast. Let's start by talking a little bit about interest rate, what's been happening historically and in the recent future, and where is it all going. Look at this chart. So this is the Federal Reserve funds rate for the last 30 years plus. As you can see, the rates used to be a lot higher, and we were in a very low, near zero environment for a long time. Since the crisis of 2008, we've been in a very, very low interest environment, and that is not normal. And Fed woke up in late 2015, in early 2016, and decided that it's time to start raising rates. And that's the right thing to do on a historic basis. So they've raised their target fund rate from zero to a quarter environment to what it is today, which is 2 to 2.25%. And they're planning to do another 5 interest rate increases, one in 2018, 3 in 2019, and one in 2020. That's the current plan. So the other thing I wanted to cover is what is the capitalization rate? Just wanted to cover the basics of the presentation so you have an idea of what we're talking about. This is a quote from Investopedia, but in layman terms, capitalization rate, or also known as a cap rate, it's a pretty basic fundamental concept. It is the rate of return on the price that you pay for a property. So it's simply calculated by taking net operating income of typically a commercial property and dividing it by a market value or the cost that you paid for it, acquisition cost or a current market price or a value. That's what the cap rate is. Here's an example of a cap rate. So let's just say you acquire something for $1 million, some small commercial property for $1 million, and it generates rent roll, gross revenues of $100,000 a year, has operating expenses of $40,000 a year, which includes typical taxes, insurance, and various operating expenses, and generates you a net operating income of $60,000 a year. So the cap rate calculation is fairly straightforward. It's $60,000 divided by $1 million, and that's 6%. Cap rate is most often used in commercial real estate. So the basic use cases for the cap rate, as I mentioned earlier, it's the most commonly used in commercial real estate, multifamily, self-storage, retail, office, industrial, and so forth. Occasionally, it is also used in investment residential real estate, single-family residential, or 2 to 4 plexes. There is an inverse relationship between cap rates and prices. And I wanted to make sure folks understand this very clearly. There is no magic to it. It's a very, very simple concept. So cap rate is simply computed as net operating income divided by the price of an asset. In this case, it's an acquisition cost, but let me just use the word price. The reverse relationship is price could be computed by taking net operating income and dividing it by the cap rate. So they're in direct or inverse relationship. So if you assume that net operating income is a fixed number for the sake of this discussion, what happens when the price of an asset goes down, then the cap rate goes up. And inversely, when the cap rate goes up, the price goes down. Similarly, the reverse happens too. When the price goes up, the cap rate goes down. And inversely, when the cap rate goes down, the price goes up. I hope this makes sense at this point. So today's environment, we are living in the environment of very low, historically speaking, cap rates. And the cap rates are likely to going to get worse. Why is that? Well, because, again, as I mentioned in the previous slide, low historic cap rates means high prices for assets. Investors are overpaying for the net operating income these assets derive. So low cap rates just means that investment community out there, the capital that's looking for deals, is just too hungry. There's too much money out there, and they're paying too much for these assets. And the reason the cap rates have been low is because interest rates have been low. And in a minute, you're going to see what happens with interest rates, with cap rates when the interest rates change. The primary problem today is that the interest rates are going up. And as I mentioned, Fed signaled that they just raised a quarter. They're likely to raise another quarter in 2018, three more in 2019, and one in 2020. And that's as far as they're projecting. They'll reevaluate as they go along. They typically try to put out projections a year out at least. So what happens when the interest rates go up? They work like gravity on real estate. They pull prices down. It's the laws of economic physics, if there's such a term. If this term is not trademarked, I'd like to trademark that. But the point is, the higher interest rates increase the cost of financing for most assets. And that reduces the cash flow after the debt service on any asset. And investors are not willing to settle for continuously lower and lower return on their investment, especially when the interest rates are rising. And the substitution effect gives them opportunity to park the money safely in a bank, earn interest rate, and not take the risk of the market. Again, cap rates are likely going to get worse. So the reason I'm stressing this is because a lot of deals today that you see coming across my desk and the whole ecosystem of deals, they're running projections that the cap rates are going to stay about the same, maybe slightly get worse. The reality is that they may get worse by more than a little bit. And that's what I'm trying to say, that you got to prepare for that environment. And if you look at the chart on the right, the commercial cap rates have come down since 2000 all the way to 2016 because the interest rates were dropping or were at a point of near zero, as we saw on a previous chart. So as interest rates go down, typically cap rates go down with them as well because, of course, the financing gets cheaper and cheaper. The reverse is true as well. So as interest rates go up, the cap rates got to get worse. I'm going to show you in the next couple of slides the math behind it. But there is no magic behind it. It's just a simple substitution effect, and it's also cost of financing effect. Affordability gets worse, cash flow gets worse with high interest rates, and investment demand better returns. And how do they get them? They pay less for each asset. So the values of or the prices of these assets get lower as interest rates go up. And the projected returns on many of these projects may not come true. Something to keep in mind. Here is an example. This is the crux of the presentation. So this is an example of what high interest rates do to cash flow, cap rates, and asset prices. So let's take a look at a very simple example. The initial price in the first scenario, the initial price of an asset is $10 million. I'm assuming 25% equity or down payment and 75% loan to value or loan to cost loan. The project, for the sake of this example, the project has fixed revenues, $1 million a year, with net operating expenses being $250,000 and net operating income, NOI, $750,000. At the moment, let's assume that's what this asset produces. It's a fixed number. It is running properly. So let's use that as the basis. And let's compare three examples with different interest rates. So example one, the interest rate is 6%. For the moment, let's just say it's a fixed interest rate for the term of a loan. The annual mortgage principal interest payment on a 6% 30-year amortization loan is approximately $539,000. So the cash flow is simply the difference between net operating income and an annual mortgage payment. So the cash flow in this particular example is $210,400. The cash on cash return, which is computed by taking cash flow and dividing it by the equity investment. So if you take $210,400 and divide by $2.5 million invested in equity, that roughly generates annualized cash on cash of 8.42%. And the debt service coverage ratio, the DSCR, which is in this case computed very simply by taking net operating income, $750,000, and dividing by annualized mortgage payments, principal and interest. And that ratio is 1.39. And that's a very solid ratio. It's not a blockbuster ratio, but it's a solid, straightforward ratio. It will meet most of the bank's DSCR requirements. Typical DSCR requirement for most banks is 1.25. Sometimes it could be 1.2, really a function of what they include, what they exclude in the DSCR calculation. But for the sake of the argument, 1.25 is a standard and typical. And the cap rate needed to keep this cash and cash return. So let me assume for the sake of the discussion, the last three rows of this table are all assuming that the investor wants to maintain cash and cash rate of return of around 8.4%. It is a reasonable cash and cash return, provides them with a good income, and they feel good about the asset. So with interest rate of 6%, that kind of a loan, that they're willing to pay $10 million for that asset. What happens when the interest rate goes higher to 7%? And I'm using these are very simple examples. So the mortgage payment, annualized mortgage payment goes up to $598,800. The cash flow goes to a little over $151,000. The cash on hand drops to slightly over 6%. DSCR, debt service coverage ratio, at that point is 1.25. And the cap rate needed to keep this cash flow now is higher. It's no longer 7.5. It's now 8.1. That's a very important point that I'm trying to convey. As interest rates have gone up by 1% points, the cap rate has gone up also by approximately 0.6%. And it's a significant change. And the most important point is that the investors are now willing to pay only $9,270,000 approximately. And that's a significant drop in price. From $10 million, it dropped to $9,270,000. That's a 7.3% drop. It's a very important data to understand that a slight reduction in the cap rate, in this case, 0.6%, impacts the price investors are paying for that asset significantly. So in this case, 0.6% reduction in the cap rate drops the price by 7.3%. Let's look at the last example, with interest rate being 8%. In that example, the annualized mortgage payment has gone now up to $660,400. The cash flow dropped to below $90,000, $89,600. And the cash on cash now is measly 3.58%. And now the debt service coverage ratio is below the expected requirement by the bank. It's now only 1.14. At that point, the bank won't even give investors enough money. Investors will have to borrow less at that interest rate to make the debt service coverage ratio compliant with bank requirements. And using the same example, the cap rate to keep the same cash and cash return now needs to be 8.7%. And that worsened cap rate will worsen the price that the investors are willing to pay for that asset. Approximately, to generate the same cash and cash return, investors will require the price to be $8,620,000. And that's a drop of 13.8% from the original $10 million that investors were willing to pay with lower interest rates. An example again, this 1% interest rate increase, additional 1% increase, now worsens the cap rate by another approximately 0.6%. So all things being equal, just using pure and simple math, what this teaches us is the fact that as interest rates increase, cap rates increase. They're not necessarily increasing exactly in the same proportion, but directionally they do increase. And then the prices people will need to pay for assets on acquisition are certainly going down. Now, what is the impact of interest rate increases on projected value at project profitability? I wanted to show you this, as there are a lot of projects out there, syndications of multifamily, self-storage, retail, office space. And there are also residential properties that go, investment portfolios that go through a similar concept. But let's use an example of a commercial deal so you can understand how it works. For the sake of the assumptions, let's start with initial purchase price of $7 million. And the property is not running in optimal condition. There's a value add component to it. I'm just giving this an example. And an additional investment of $1 million increases the value of the project. And the investor goes to the bank, and the bank is willing to provide $6 million loan, approximately 75% of cost, and investors bring in $2 million equity. The total cost basis is roughly $8 million. Right now, I'm discounting, well, bank closing fees and all that stuff. For sake of the argument, let's leave it alone. This is just simple math. And let's just say the project, upon completion, after the improvements have been done, the apartments renovated, or construction work or rehabilitation work is finished, and the asset is now performing at the full net operating income. It's the same data as the previous slide. So it's $1 million rent roll, $250,000 operating expenses, and the NOI of $750,000. And let's just say it takes 3-year life cycle. The reason it takes 3 years because it takes time to do renovations, it takes time to change the tenants who are paying higher rents, and then ultimately starts cash flow. So I'm just using this for the sake of a discussion. And again, let's compare three examples of the loan interest rates. So as we saw from previous slides, at 6% interest rate, investors would be willing to pay 7.5% cap rate or $10 million price for this asset. And in that case, the capital gain on sale of an asset of $10 million, again, I'm discounting sales costs for the sake of the argument, it's a $2 million capital gain profit, the difference between $10 million and cost basis of $8 million. And that's a 100% capital gain return on equity. So equity was $2 million and the profit was $2 million. So it's a capital gain divide. I'm discounting the cash flow. I wanted to leave cash flow alone because cash flow is not going to change in this scenario. Whatever cash flow is, that's great. But beyond the cash flow, the significant portion of the return on projects is capital gain. And the capital gain in this case represents 100% return on the invested capital over 3 years. So the internal rate of return, it's an annualized rate of return. It's in layman terms, that's what it stands for. So you take 100% return and you divide it over 3 years and you wind up with an annualized return of 33.3%. That ain't too shabby. That's not bad at all. That's a pretty decent project. From there's also additional return in the form of cash flow that has been paid over these 3 years. So overall project return could be very, very solid. So this is what happens if the cap rates stay flat at 6%. But if the cap rates go up, let's just say over a period of the project life cycle, interest rates go to 7%. And on exit, the project sponsor, all they're able to obtain as a sales price is $9,270,000. that will generate capital gain only of $1,270,000, and that's on 2 million invested. That's roughly 63.5% return over 3 years, and that's a significant drop from a previous 100% return. As you could see, small change in interest rate or small change in the cap rate is pretty impactful here on the overall project profitability. So the IRR now dropped from 33.33% with interest rates being at 6%, now down to 21.67% when interest rates have increased. And if you now look at the 8% scenario, it gets even worse. So the cap rate, required cap rate, goes up to 8.7%. The sales price goes down to $8,620,000. And the capital gain is only $620,000. The equity return on capital invested is now $620,000. That's only 31%. It's a big drop from the original projection. And the annualized rate of return, or IRR in this case, only 10.33%, again, excluding the cash flow. I hope it makes sense. I hope you see the picture, what happens with project profitability and returns when the interest rates go up. Now, let's discuss a very, very important point. Is it possible for the asset prices not to fall, even with rising interest rates? Yes, it is very possible. And in the environment of inflation, where the gross rents increase over time. So typically, Fed raises interest rates when there is inflation expected. And for the sake of a discussion, in the inflation environment, the rents go up. As the rents go up, the net operating income will go up. So the asset will adjust for higher cost of finances by virtue of having higher rent roll and higher net operating income. So the price may stay flat, might even go up if the rents grow faster than interest rate increases. Let's go back to let's talk a little bit about the Federal Reserve mandate and what they do and why they raise interest rates. Well, what's happening with the economy is overheating as far as the Federal Reserve data is concerned. Why is the economy overheating? Fed has a dual mandate. Number one, they're required to keep full employment. In other words, their whole job is to fight unemployment. And the way they do it is when unemployment is high, they lower the rates. And when unemployment is low, and we are historically low environment, we're now environment, unemployment is as low as when the man put, as when the human race put a man on the moon. So we are now at a historically low unemployment point, and Fed is driven. Their mandate is telling them raise rates as fast as you could possibly do, because they need to accommodate that. The second mandate that they have is they got to fight inflation. So the inflation fighting responsibility, they only have one tool. They have dual mandate, but only one tool. Inflation is not out of control yet. It is certainly out there. We know there is a street inflation, but the Fed tracked CPI is not as bad as their mandate on unemployment. But the unemployment mandate is driving them to raise rates faster than they would have under the inflation-only environment. In this case, inflation, in a broad sense, means prices and incomes rise widely. Now, there's a difference between income inflation and commodity inflation or price inflation. And at times, income inflation doesn't keep up with commodity inflation or price inflation. Right now, we're dealing with the trade war or trade dispute situation with China. And until that gets resolved, there could be significant commodity inflation ahead of the income inflation because of the trade war and the imposed tariffs. In general, inflation implies higher gross rents on properties, which implies higher net operating income, which allows higher debt service and better cash flows. So the answer to this question, yes, it is possible that the rising interest rates will not cause asset prices to fall. So maybe interest rate increases are good for real estate. Well, that's a great question, but the answer is in the long run, yes. In the long run, real estate is a hedge against inflation. As rents increase and the debt amount is fixed, the inflation destroys the value of the debt over a long period of time. In terms of real dollars, the debt is worth less and less. So real estate actually wants inflation as long as they're able to increase rents and ultimately net operating income with a fixed debt service. That's an ideal environment for real estate investors. So from that perspective, long-term fixed rate loans are great when there is inflation. However, in the short run, quickly rising interest rates could cause serious debt problems, even debt crisis. This is a very, very, very important point that I wanted to convey. Let's look at the example. So let's take a commercial property that was financed with a 5-1 ARM loan in 2015. Why 5-1 ARM loan? Well, a lot of commercial properties are financed on a 5-year term. Sometimes they're 5 and 5, sometimes they're 10 years, sometimes they're 7 years, but I'm just using this as an example. There's been plenty of 5-year fixed loans out there. And in 2015, the rates were very low, and you could have gotten easily, I'm using this as an example, 4.5, the rates were even lower than that. So on a commercial deal, you could have gotten a mortgage below 4%. But for the sake of the argument, say the rate was 4.5%. And 5 years later comes 2020. We've been going through rapid interest rate increases by the Fed, started in 2016. Now we are through most of 2018. And by the time 2020 comes, the interest rates could be higher by another 1.5% or even more. So the interest rate on a refinance loan could be as high as 7.5%. Now, it doesn't mean it'll be 7.5%, but I wanted to show a significant contrast. So the difference in the rate between 5 years ago and now could be easily 3%. So 3% delta in the interest rates is massive on a financing of a property. So if the rents don't go up fast enough, the refinancing will require significant amount of equity capital contribution. Or debt service coverage ratio will not meet bank requirements because high interest rates will require incomes to be even higher because debt service coverage ratio is about 1.25 of the actual debt service required. So in other words, the net operating income needs to be growing faster than the debt service on a given loan. So a lot of these assets will come to refi point and the bank will call the note and there will be crisis from the point of view that all of them will be in a default and there will be all kinds of workouts and problem solving situation. So debt crisis in real estate may or may not take place, but I'm just giving this an example. There are many other areas of the economy that are heavily over leveraged and there's a lot of debt and the debt works at low interest rates, but as interest rates go up, the debt over encumbers these properties with interest payments that they cannot sustain. And again, it's not the interest rate itself the problem. It's the velocity of interest rate increases. So the Fed cut the rates very quickly, which was the right thing to do to salvage the economy. But when they increase rates, they have to do it very slowly over many years so that the impact of interest rate increases is not causing any shocks in the economy. And they're very well aware of it. They're pretty smart people out there, but I wanted to stress this out. In my opinion, the interest rate increases are happening faster than that they should be. So it's a danger zone, not necessarily crisis yet, but we absolutely have to be aware of the situation. Let's continue. So again, the major risk is that the Fed is raising interest rates too fast. And there is no specific magic number. But it's happening, and they don't know how fast they got to do. But unemployment is so low that it's forcing them to accelerate the interest rate because they're trying to cool down the economy. And many assets are over-leveraged in the entire U.S. economy and the world based on very low interest rates. We've gotten too used to low interest rates, and this leverage can cause all kinds of grief in the future. Incomes are rising, but they are rising slower than the pace of Fed rate increases. Again, this is inflation. We're talking about inflation is not that high. Relatively speaking, inflation is slower than what the Fed is doing with short-term interest rates. So The problem with short-term interest rates is the short-term interest rates increases are very deflationary. They slow down inflation fast and hard. Really important point here. So we have low unemployment in the economy. Fed is fighting that low, well, it's not fighting, but it's slowing down the economy. It's basically required to do that because unemployment is low. But the inflation is not out of control. Inflation is not running very high. So by raising interest rates at the speed they're doing now, they are causing grief to inflation. They're basically going to slow down inflation because of the substitution effect. High interest rates means people don't go spend the money. They put the money in the bank, forces savings. It's very basic laws. It's a 101 of economics. So fast rising interest rates are likely to slow down many sectors of the economy because borrowing is becoming more expensive and existing loans with variable rates start costing more and more. The second impact of that is of rising interest rates. It could cause crisis or significant problems for maturing loans that need to be refinanced or loans that have rate reset. When those rate resets kick in, they cause significant problems on those assets. Also, what happens is interest rates increase cost of capital for U.S. corporations. And that puts downward pressure on earnings. As corporations need to pay more and more on their debt, their price-to-earning ratio gets worse. Their earnings could come down. And that causes prices to go down. As a consequence of that, they reduce spending, and then the recession cycle starts. So there's a risk ahead. And there's nothing new. I'm not saying anything that people are not expecting. But I'm just explaining the basics of how it works. There's a risk of rising interest rates will be like gravity on real estate and like gravity on stocks and earnings of corporations. Everything could be nice and steady until it all goes down. And typically when problems happen, they happen fast and hard. And when things go up, they go up slow and steady. So crisis could be looming around the corner or significant correction, even though everything is looking totally fine now. How to prepare for rising interest rates environment? Well, number one, the most simple way to do this is refinance today, locking long-term fixed interest rates. This is very important. The rates are still decent on long-term basis from historical perspective. So whatever projects you invest in or whatever projects you take over or whatever your investment opportunities, take advantage of fixed long-term rates. That's the number one risk mitigation strategy. The number two strategy, which could also go together with number one, is you reduce leverage in projects with variable interest rates. So if you have a shorter term rate fixed or it's a variable rate, reduce leverage. Pay down some debt, and that'll reduce the debt service and it'll make the project safer. Take on equity partners rather than more debt. This is a very important consideration. Whatever you invest in, equity is much more patient, number one. Number two, having good partners may help the project. They may have credit partners, you may have experienced partners, you may have capital partners. But take on partners, diversify your risk. It reduces your upside, but it significantly reduces downside. And we are at that point in the economic cycle where downside protection is more important than worrying about ripping all the rewards of the upside. The next thing you could do is increase cash flow reserves. This is another very, very important consideration. Cash is king. Having cash, it begins to earn interest because banks start paying actually interest rate higher on the deposits. Number one, it's no longer as passive as it was in the past. The second thing is it can help you pay down the debt if interest rates go up. So this is very important as well. It's a second consideration. It becomes reserves that help you deal with crises or problems. And number three, it could be an opportunistic capital to take advantage of the opportunities when the correction kicks in and the better deals come to the table. You could take advantage of those opportunities. The next thing you can do is diversify your investments. This is as basic as it goes. Diversify, diversify, diversify across many types of sectors, regions, project sponsors, fund managers, type of assets everywhere. Just diversify. The more diversified portfolio you have, the better you're prepared to deal with downturn. Because some sectors will do better than others, some regions will do better than others, and so on and so forth. And also focus on cash flow. The cash is the king. So if you invest in deals with lower debt service coverage ratio and a great fixed long-term interest rate, that alone creates safety. You will have the cash flow. You have ability to absorb economic recession, some level of higher vacancy, and so forth. Because the service coverage ratio is high, you can actually manage fluctuations in the short-term problems. Even in long-term problems, you can manage operating a property at a higher vacancy. These are very simple, very powerful steps you can take to prepare your portfolio for rising interest rates. So how do you invest in how do you invest with a downside protection? What kind of investments do you make to protect yourself against interest rates increasing and prices going down? So number one, select, this is true for any environment, but it's even more important in the downside protection. So work with the right people. Invest with people with integrity, experience, track record, and conservative investment philosophy. Whoever you invest with, those four sectors, well, those four points are very, very important. Invest with people you know, like, and trust. Trust is the key word here, obviously. They've had a good track record. They're good people. And their philosophy is such that they're preparing for downturn rather than trying to over-leverage and take advantage of the risky deals. Invest in value-add projects. Why value-add projects? Well, because these projects have increasing cash flow due to the value-add work. So what is value-add? Value-add, in simple terms, renovations, development, redevelopment, improvements, additional services, all the things that get implemented to increase cash flows, value of the asset. And it creates forced appreciation because these properties are older, rundown properties now look better. They're rented for higher income. They generate better cash flows, and the value of those assets goes up. So if it's a downside and the market corrects and the prices come down, you're protected from the point of view that the project itself has a forced appreciation, high level of equity built in through the work on the project. So review underwriting assumptions carefully. Prepare for worsening exit or refinance values and cap rates. This is very, very important. So the projects you invest in, make sure it's underwritten conservatively as far as the valuation on the back end. Also, invest in short-term loans and debt secured by quality assets. Typically, used to be LTV below 65%. In today's environment, very competitive rates is below 75%. I do not, under any circumstances, recommend going over 75%. Stick with 75%, ideally 70%. If you can get down to 65%, phenomenal. You will get a lesser rate of return on lower LTV that'll create higher degree of safety. And make sure that every project you invest into has a good exit strategy. The next question, just to give you some idea how you can evaluate projects and opportunities. The question is, should we invest in individual deals or invest in the funds like ours in this environment? Well, this is a comparison, just a couple of words about this. When you invest in an individual deal, there's a risk concentration, high volatility. A project could do really well or could do poorly. You have high exposure. When you invest in the fund, you have lower volatility and high diversification. Also, liquidity, which is very important. If you want to maintain high liquidity, you're often better off investing in a fund than in a project. However, this varies. It depends on the type of fund. In our fund, we maintain very high liquidity. There are other funds that are not liquid. So absolutely understand individual fund liquidity. Individual project liquidity is typically not there until the project goes through their life cycle, gets to the refi or sale point. Personal guarantees. Typically, as an investor, you don't want to do a personal guarantee. We don't do it on a fund level either. So we have no personal guarantees, even by us fund managers, nor you investors. Some projects we invest directly. If you're a significant equity participant, the bank may require recourse loans with personal guarantees. And there's a potential liability risk when you invest in individual projects. While when you invest in a fund, you certainly have very limited liability risks. Again, investing in individual assets, you're more active and you are completely passive when you invest in a fund. Also, individual assets often repay. If it's a short duration project, you get your money back. What do you do with that? You're stuck. Your money's sitting and earning nothing or very little. When funds invested in a fund, when capital is invested in a fund, it's always working. For IRA investors, be aware of the leverage on projects. If you invest from an IRA and the project has a mortgage, it can create UBIT or UDFI, to be exact, related to the leverage. If you're not sure, reach out to me. I'll explain how it works. On a fund level, if there's no leverage on a fund level, there is no UBIT. And when you invest in individual projects, one of the considerations is you must have the right amount of capital. If you have too much, it's no good. If you have too little, it's no good. When you invest in a fund, it's much more flexible. You can start with some amount of money. You can reinvest distribution and add or redeem units and take some money out. It's a lot more flexible. A couple of words about our flagship fund, Tempo Opportunity Fund. Again, this is not a solicitation. I'm just giving you recent results and absolutely request prospectus if you're interested and request private placement memorandum. So this is the type of fund. This is a growth and income fund. We invest in value-add equity projects and fix and flip hard money loans. Very straightforward strategy. The fund has 7% preferred return and a target annualized return 10 to 13%. Trailing 12 months are well above the target, but I wanted to set much more conservative expectations over time in the environment of interest rates increases. I would expect that the target returns will come down to the range where they are here, 10 to 13%. So I'd like to be very conservative, set much more realistic expectations. We're running above the target over time. It'll likely come down. The last quarter distribution, you can actually see. So the fund has two type of income. Part of it comes from distribution. Part of it comes from value add appreciation on projects. Distributions are right now running from, this is from Q2 2018. As you can see, depending on type of units, we're running, you know, in the 9% plus range. This is just distributions. The fund capital was around 9 million at the end of Q2. We now exceeded 10 million at the start of Q3 2018, where it should be well above 10 million. And we continue to grow the fund and make downside protective investments. We're trying to mitigate the risk. Our whole strategy is to prepare for market, some level of market corrections, but we're still focused on generating high yield and value add built-in equity on projects. Obviously, there are no guarantees, and there's certainly risk involved by investing in any fund or anything speculative. This is, again, a growth and income fund. Distributions are quarterly, and you're allowed to reinvest distributions. I'm at your service. You can find me at bigmikefund.com. There's also that podcast is available on our website and iTunes. Our website is tempofunding.com. And if you're interested in the fund, you can actually go to the website, secure.tempofunding.com, create an account, log in, download PPM, term sheet, subscription booklet, and all other information through that website. The website does allow electronic subscription. In addition, you can email me and I could send you PPM and other documents. If you'd like the book, please go to Amazon. You can also email me. You could request the book through Amazon, or you could do it directly by emailing. If you want to speak with me, I have a very busy schedule just in advance. Please text me, let me know who you are. And we generally take business only on referral. If somebody referred you, let me know who referred you. We take very little cold leads. Unless you have a good story, we will not be, unfortunately, spending time on the phone. So I appreciate your time. Thank you again for listening, and have a great rest of the day.
Thank you for listening to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. To receive your copy of Mike's How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Fund book, head to bigmikefund.com or visit Amazon and type Mike Zlotnick. Keep listening and keep investing Big Mike style. See you on the next episode.